Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this broadcast is World Watchers. It's broadcast number 715, August 19th, 1985. I have one announcement to make regarding Kazoo Radio Station. The two women who have worked in the office assisted with the programming as programming director and the billing and the mailing and setting up the various schedules have left the station, and right now the manager, the new director, has been selected. He'll be starting work there on August the 7th. His title will be executive manager. The man who's been hired by the board of Kazoo, his name is Ron Paul, P-A-U-L. He was formerly third in command of the Navy Postgraduate School here on the Monterey Peninsula. That is the creme de la creme of the military, Navy, and this is a very important place here. All the top Navy, of course, come here, and many retire here. It's for advanced training when they finish Annapolis and other colleges to get in the technical skills of whatever it takes to make war. And there are many quotations of meetings they have there of the highest of the country along those lines. He is retired. He was formerly third in command of the Navy Postgraduate School, and he's coming to a small listener-sponsored radio station, Kazoo, in Pacific Grove, California, and will be known as the executive manager. I hope that World Watchers will continue on that station. I hope the station continues and doesn't just close up. But I thought I should mention it to you because those changes are significant, and I don't have to say any more. There are differences of opinion between Mae Brussel and the military, obviously. I think the military should defend this country. I do not look forward to World War III, and I believe that many people in the military and in private life have been doing things that are really equal to treason, that are not in the best interest of the way this country was set up. So when you're high in command, I know that there have to be a lot of differences because there's a lot of people, just ordinary sailors around, who don't like Mae Brussel and the kind of things she's talking about, or veterans from Vietnam who've expressed the opinion. And I'm not anti-war, but I have my strong opinions on those things. So I hope World Watchers is on Kazoo, but I want to tell you that this change has taken place, and we'll see what it brings. Now, I did promise to do some more on Simon Wiesenthal. I've had a lot of articles, a lot of information about him over the years. I've observed the things that the Wiesenthal Center's been doing and saying, and a lot of what they haven't been doing and saying, which is equally important. But I got into Wiesenthal more seriously to share information with you after he so easily accepted the findings of Romeo Tuma, the chief of police in Brazil, the federal police who ran the equivalent of the death squads and the tool of the military dictators for so long, and also hindered the extradition of a Mr. Wagner. I'll do more on that. I've done some already. And the day that they said they found Joseph Mengele, Simon Wiesenthal, you recall, said, "I'm skeptical." And then the second day, by June the 7th, he said, "I'm more likely to believe it." And then he fell right in line that that body was Joseph Mengele, and I don't believe for a minute it is. And I'll get back to the evidence that they used to come to that conclusion and the people involved in it. But in the meantime, I want to do part three just on Simon Wiesenthal. I did two broadcasts, one July 22nd, numbered 711, on special favors he got in Poland through the war years, and then July 29th, part another section on Simon Wiesenthal, tape 712, some more special favors that he got. And then when he left the Army, he went into left the concentration camp, went into the U.S. Army, then the OSS and the Counterintelligence Corps, and worked for them, and then set up his centers, which have been very effective in not getting the members of the ODESA, the network of Nazis that do in fact exist. As a matter of fact, CNN cable news broadcasting is advertising the Life magazine series on Nazism in World War II. And they had a segment showing Hitler's top people, Mr. Himmler and Goebbels and Goering. And then in the advertisement, they said, did Nazism die with Hitler, or is it waiting to emerge again? So they're asking that question on television. They know the answer. Ted Turner's Broadcasting and Life magazine know that answer, and they're planting that idea. Yes, they could, and that's the way it runs. Now, the Simon Wiesenthal Center issues their reports quarterly. Summer of 1985, the Mengele case was just coming to a conclusion, and the title of their membership report was A Special Update, the Mengele Case. And it says, as they're going to press, we don't know, in fact, if it was Mengele. The center dispatched an expert team of forensic scientists led by Dr. Clyde Snow of Oklahoma, along with our complete Mengele dossier to San Paulo. But the central question remains, why now, after all these years? He lived peacefully, little trouble, for three decades in South America. Then his bulletin says, he escaped justice because no one cared. No one was searching except Simon Wiesenthal. For nearly 40 years, the Nazi hunter stood a lonely and frustrating vigil. That's his bulletin, making out that he is the one who alone was looking for them. And as of 1983, I had contacted the Wiesenthal Center, or tried to, with the fact that money from DeLorean's cocaine, that cash that bought that cocaine that was in the hotel room, was allegedly from Klaus Barbie and was put in the bank account of Joseph Mengele. And it was only, as I have said many times, that he became very open about looking for Mengele when the tracks went to Fritz Steinecker, the attorney who was in Zurich. And then all of a sudden, a team was put in, including Mr. Simon Wiesenthal, to close the door, not open the door, when the trail got very hot. But you can't influence the world on this. His bulletin is sent all over to multimillionaires around this country and up in Canada and so forth and in Europe. And he says that he had the lonely vigil. So we'll continue now on some points, just a few on asking the question, who is Simon Wiesenthal? And leaving off in 1945, the war was over in May 45, and within about 6 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks, he was working for the U.S. Army. Now, in 1946, he describes in his own book, and I'm using three sources here for this information, three or four, the Wiesenthal Center bulletins, his book, The Murderers Amongst Us, an interview in Saga magazine in 1979, and I believe 79, I'll have the date here in a minute, and on another page, and also a Washington Post interview in 1979. In December 1946, he described, I would be arresting Nazis, and his role was to go up and get various Nazis that were around his area in Vienna and Linz and so forth. And then he says the superiors would let them go. Now, he wasn't a policeman. He was a trained engineer and architect, so I don't know what he was out in the field arresting Nazis, how he got that kind of power. But then he left the work that he was doing and formed a team called the 30 Desperados. He left American intelligence that he was working for after the war and formed the Jewish Documentation Center in Linz, Austria by 1947. And the 30 Desperados were the people hired to help him. Now, there are committees that splinter off from the intelligence, from the OSS, and later the CIA, Bernard Fensterwald's committee to investigate assassinations, a splinter of the CIA that's supposed to find who killed John Kennedy. Mark Lane had gone to Eastern Europe and then London to write Rush to Judgment with Hugh Trevor Roper as British intelligence doing the introduction. And Mr. Murchison, as controlling stockholder of Holt Reinhardt and Winston, at least at that time, putting up the money for the book. So out of the Kennedy assassination, they promote the person whose name is associated with the murder and then can sit on the Odessa Nazi connections and keep all evidence for 21 years located at the grassy knoll. So the question I wonder is, was the center set up by the United States intelligence just identical the way it is done for just one example, the political assassinations. And who were the 30, in quotes, desperados the Jewish Documentation Center evolved from the OSS to his center? Now, in 1946, when he was setting that up and working for the United States Army, his wife, Cyla, C-Y-L-A, returned. She was with them at the concentration camp railroad yards, employed. She walked away. He was never taken to a camp and killed because his wife escaped. Later, he walked away and was brought back and wined and died. And when he was with the SS, the Gestapo SS, a handful of 20 or more of them, just a small enclave towards the end of the war, I cited a few weeks ago how he wanted to get in touch through the underground with his wife. Now, working with the SS Gestapo at that time, certainly that would jeopardize the people who had her and would jeopardize him trying to contact her. And how would he have any inkling, after all that was going on by early 45, before the war was over, he was trying to send messages they were near each other. Well, she was living in Krakow, Poland. She returned. They had a daughter, and they lived happily ever after. I think she passed away not too long ago. So he set up a correspondence with displaced persons. And no wonder, see, Simon Wiesenthal is so much loved, not for the people he got. He catapulted to fame for bringing in Adolf Eichmann, and he cut a deal to get Mr. Stengel. That was offered to him, and we'll get to that in a second. But he found people who belonged to other people or told them where their loved ones had gone or deceased, and he became beloved to them because instead of going for the Odessa, just as his bulletin says, only one man for 40 years held that vigil for Joseph Mengele, he was working with displaced people and 200,000 survivors of the camps. And within 3 months of when he set up his office, he listed 1,000 locations where war crimes existed. Well, we know they exist. It's like having 48 universities that did medical experiments in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. It's who did them. Those names are kept secret, and they were never prosecuted. We know the camps existed, and he compiled the list of the witnesses gave him of names of people who ran the camps who were war, by definition, I suppose, war criminals of a sort, but people like Joseph Mengele worked for the United States Army. He was under the control of the CIC and was released. Klaus Barbie was under the control of young officer Henry Kissinger, and Kissinger under Fritz Kramer, and he was released. He worked for the Army and then was sent down to South America, as was Mengele. And Fritz Kramer was taken out of the Dachau prison, and never a trace of him since. Hitler's general Fritz Kramer, who I think is the one running our plans in the Pentagon, although in quotes retired, and with Daniel Graham of Star Wars. We still can't prove or disprove that, but that one disappeared from the face of the earth. But Mr. Piper, Joachim Piper, and Sepp Dietrich, and Otto Skorzeny, all the Odessa men that worked with Martin Bormann in out of Madrid and down to South America were gone from Europe, and a handful of them are at the Nuremberg trial. And so while he's collecting names of witnesses who saw guards that were cruel, the duplication of the system can be done because the geniuses are out alive. Now, I don't believe for a moment that Rudolf Hess is in Spandau prison, and after he flew to England, there are many routes he could have taken, but Hess was the genius behind Hitler. He is supposed to have been the one who wrote Mein Kampf while with Hitler in jail, the man who could so well state the goals, and he set up all the South American connections where the top Gestapo, with the aid of the Vatican and our intelligence community, sent them. Wiesenthal describes in 1946, and a few years later, the Cold War began, and then Germany became a prize, that they were on our side. We weren't enemies, and of course, this was going on during the entire war. Just reading Trading with the Enemy or America Swastika, the two books by Charles Higham, and the interest in the Nazis dwindled. He describes how the interest had dwindled and people weren't interested anymore. So his documentation center in 1947 was working. He helped release two Nazis, Sturmführers. One was a Mr. Beck in 1947. He went to the trials and said that They should be free. These ex-Nazis are not a problem. And an SS officer, Werner Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-D-T, an officer he knew at the Ostbahn Railroad Works. He also was in contact with a Rudolf Kastner, and later he found out that even though Kastner was a Jew, the Israeli Supreme Court of Wartime Collaboration named him as a collaborator with the Nazi SS. Of course, the importance of Skorzeny and Kramer and Piper and Dietrich getting off is that they worked with Hans-Ulrich Rudel, another top Nazi and the head of the Luftwaffe, who wasn't on any list of Simon Wiesenthal, and Rudel and SS Karl Wolff, and I'll list over and over again, the biggies that worked with Alan Dulles, William Donovan, Heinrich Himmler, and the Vatican, and they got off. Now, in 1954, Wiesenthal writes about his interest in the denazification and how nobody else is interested in it, and therefore he closes his center. It didn't run very long. Denazification wasn't in. Anti-Russian was in, and he seemed to go full swing with the Cold War, and today that center is talking about Mr. Wallenberg in the Soviet Union as being the number one problem in the world. This is before Mengele was even tucked away in San Paulo, even as a story. So his center closed there, and he began to increase his work with displaced people, and the interest now, as I say, was in Soviet Union. In 1954, he scrapped all his work, and his helpers went away, his 30 desperados, he closed his center, and he only kept one file there. He gave the rest to Israel, and Israel wasn't interested in any of these things, and there's documentation that they never were interested in Joseph Mengele, and knew where he was all the time. He kept one file, Adolf Eichmann. Now, this is like getting one part in Gone with the Wind or catapulting to fame in one thing. The Adolf Eichmann case, which documentation proves he did very little to do the Mossad did, but it catapulted him to that place where Wiesenthal became synonymous with being a great Nazi catcher. And he kept the Eichmann file and gave the rest to Israel. Now, interestingly enough, Otto von Bolschwing, described in various books that Death's Head, not too many, but some of them, was Eichmann's superior. He came to this country, worked for Warner Lambert, and Elmer Bobst helped put Richard Nixon into office. He set up his corporation, TCI, in Palo Alto. On the board were the Gettys and a who's who of the military defense, and then the secretary was Helene von Damm for Ronald Reagan. So the Odessa Network was working through Philco Ford, Stanford Research, the multinationals in the Bay Area, in San Francisco and Sacramento, where the power is, that were able to put Nixon and Reagan into the presidency through various assassinations, and Eichmann was the star of the Academy Award of Simon Wiesenthal that put him to fame. He kept the Eichmann file, and in 1959, the Israelis found out where Adolf Eichmann was, and Mengele also was close by. That's why in 1960, when they picked up Adolf Eichmann, Mengele did go into hiding in Brazil at the Stammers and had to stay quiet for a while and then officially be buried before he could become international as the dope dealer that he was, written up by the Central Intelligence Agency in 1979, and close ties to Klaus Barbie. So the success brought from the fame to Simon Wiesenthal of finding Eichmann opened up again a center in Vienna, and he officially was the Eichmann pursuer, and the Eichmann case brought attention to him, and he appeared to be wanting Nazis that were floating around. In exchange for that, as of 1985, he has what's going to be a $100 million building in Washington, D.C., and a $20 million building in Beverly Hills, and a staff and a board and media attention, and he's hoping to get the Nobel Peace Prize, which is so horrendous, but if Henry Kissinger got it, I suppose Wiesenthal can get it. By 1961, when Eichmann was captured and Wiesenthal opened up his office in Vienna, he opened what he called the Federation of Jewish Victims of Nazi Regimes. And again, I'm not putting down the need to help the victims, but what he was doing and what many people have done is they pursue what happened in the past and help those people. And you have the Turing twins and the horror of Mengele, and you talk about this angel of death over and over, over ad infinitum. It just never ends. And the point is, the victims need attention, but we're going to be the next victims. When a man named William Pierce writes the Turner Diaries, and he's paid by the Air Force, a PhD working for United Technology, where Alexander Haig is the head, and he tells you he's going to hang every Jew on a pole across the United States. And just this week, the FAA said yes in Kansas City. Reverend Gale's tapes can be played on the air on how to kill Jews and how to kill blacks. That's acceptable. So helping the victims of the past isn't as important in my mind as helping us not go through it again. So what, in exchange for his fame and his money, he has centered his attention on the past and wants you to look at the horror of the past without letting the future, which is building up like the serpent's egg, be exposed. Now, as soon as he opened up that center in 1962, the Documentation Center in Vienna, he was getting money from the Dutch Netherlands, from people from Johannesburg, Frankfurt, Germany, Munich, Milan, and Turin. Those are interesting because of the drug connections later that tied down to Sao Paulo, Brazil, and Romeo Tuma from Syria, and the Syrian connections to Steve Baum and the P2 and so forth. I'll do more on that later. Now, Frank Wiesner was deputy director of plans for the Central Intelligence Agency. David Emery found this quotation in John Loftus's book, not quotation, several pages of it. I've read the book several times, but sometimes there's certain names that you do forget until Wiesenthal reappears again, and he shows up in John Loftus's book, The Belarus Secret, and it tells about Frank Wiesner, of the CIA head of covert operations, and how he used Nazis and members of the Gestapo, and their SS records were faked to work in the United States and rewritten to say that they worked in the resistance and that they had been imprisoned by the Gestapo. In fact, most of the history books you see where they refer to Nazis that are high up in government now, they say they were part of the plot to try to kill Hitler, or they were found in concentration camps. The witnesses to help identify Mengele, the one that he had a lift in his shoe, was his butler at a concentration camp. Well, Wiesner's secret army became the nucleus of the Green Berets, that private army that goes out now with Soldier of Fortune and set up by John Singlaub and Robert Brown. But Frank Wiesner set up the Green Berets, and before 1947, these Nazi war criminals were brought to the United States. In 1961, there was a trial in Europe, in Germany, that was hushed in this country, and they wanted two top Nazis. One was Franz Kuschel, K-U-S-H-E-L, and the other was Emanuel Jasiuk, J-A-S-I-U-K. I may not pronounce this right. And they wanted these people for the crimes that they committed in Eastern Europe against Russia, and we had brought them to this country by lying about their past, and as I say, putting them into the CIA, where they later trained and still do death squads and killings and the Central American, South American bloodbaths, and also Southeast Asian, along with the Phoenix program and that type of thing, were special training by SS Gestapo. But in the book, The Belarus Secret, by John Loftus, he tells about a Yiddish newspaper in New York having an article about these two men and giving the account of the trial in the Soviet Union and how they participated in atrocities and at the death camp in Belarus. And Jasiuk and Kuschel were named as the key officials in the Nazi administration who sent thousands of people to death in the camps. So when the accusations were made, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI called Simon Wiesenthal. This is where he's so useful. And they said the noted Nazi hunter, who had warned that these charges would be a communist Cold War tactic to intimidate the emigre community. Wiesenthal has always protected Reinhard Gehlen, the paperclip scientist. I'll rattle them all for you and give you names of them. He thought that telling these people who were killing Russians, see, it's okay to kill Russians, but you're not supposed to kill Jews. And if they had mass murders of Russians, this was Cold War. And he defended what is called the emigre community, that were nothing but Gestapo killers. So the FBI dropped any investigation into these people and said for all purposes they were ignored. Then later, the FBI had known the entire history of the Belarusian Nazi government since the 1950s. They knew that Kuschel and Jasuic were two of the most important war criminals in the United States. This is from the Bolera Secret. The FBI was aware that both men had ties to the OPC through the American Committee for Liberation from Bolshevism, which funded their activities. So citing Simon Wiesenthal, which his unfortunate comment about don't discredit them, the FBI reported to the Immigration Service that the Soviet charges were part of a plot to discredit important anti-communist political figures. When similar denunciations followed, the FBI noted every case that the accused were staunch anti-communists. And this went on, and finally, the investigation kept going on. The Immigration Service didn't rest on the assurances of the FBI or Simon Wiesenthal, as it had before. They called in the U.S. Army's Investigative Records Repository at Fort Meade, Maryland, and asked if the CIC and the criminal investigation, that was Simon Wiesenthal working for U.S. Army, as soon as he was out of the camp and had been traveling with the SS Gestapo, they asked the CIC if they had any information on Kuschel. The CIC recalled and possessed several classified dossiers dating back to the late 40s that positively identified Kuschel as an SS officer, a member of the Nazi government of Belarus, an informant for the SS intelligence. But after one telephone call from CIC in 1963, the Immigration Service noted in its records that Mr. Woolwine advised that the CIC records show that Kuschel was the leader of the Micheldorf displaced persons camp. They sanitized the Pentagon report. They changed it. The agency changed it around and gave a false background on the writing of these people in 56. It furnished a CIA OSO sanitized version of their history and literally changed history with a fountain pen to lie about who these particular people are and their background. The Kuschel investigation was terminated almost immediately after the CIA reported that they had no derogatory information on Kuschel. Recently, a CIA official was asked to define what it means by no derogatory information. He responded, it means there was no evidence of pro-communist activity. In our federal government, Nazism was regarded as anti-communism. Therefore, information that a person was a Nazi is not considered derogatory. This was not simply doublespeak. The intelligence community has a precise language all its own. If the CIA was asked whether it ever employed Nazis as an agent, they would say no. On further inquiry, the researcher knew enough to ask, he would discover that an employee does not include someone employed by a CIA front organization, and an agent does not include people who worked for Wiesner's guerrilla forces because they weren't on the United States government payroll. But any derogatory information means that if you're pro-communist, then you're a danger. But if you're a Nazi, it never has been and never will be that this is anything against you or derogatory. And they can rewrite it, with, as I say, with a fountain pen and alter the background of these people to make them acceptable. Now, this was going on in the 1960s. By 1962, Adolf Eichmann was hung in Israel. While the trial was going on, Martin Bormann was sending messages to him. In fact, Eichmann's son was living with Jack Anderson. I'll do more on that maybe next week or so. While the trial of Adolf Eichmann was going on in Israel, his son was living with Jack Anderson, and Martin Bormann was sending letters to Eichmann from South America, and yet, very openly and quoted in Saga magazine and other sources, the Wiesenthal Center has always said that Martin Bormann is dead. John Judge sent me from Washington the Jack Anderson newsletter, April 1985, Volume 2, Number 8. The source of this was a Philadelphia subscriber wanted to know whether it's true. I once housed as my house guest the son of Nazi mass murderer Adolf Eichmann. It's quite true. While Eichmann was on trial in Israel for his atrocities, I located his family and brought one of his four sons to the United States for in-depth interviews. He stayed at my home where he received letters from his war criminal father. The last I heard of Nick Eichmann, the son who visited my house, he had gone to Germany to join the Nazi underground. This is from John Judge, who sent me a copy of Jack Anderson's newsletter, where Eichmann's son is staying at Jack Anderson's home. And remember, Jack Anderson's 20-year, 25-year now or more association with Frank Sturgis, Frank Farino, who worked with Lee Harvey Oswald, the Permandex, the team that killed John Kennedy, and Borman has been linked to that murder through treason, through My Daily Bread, for My Daily Bread, that book. And I've cited it in my references to the Nazis and the JFK assassination. We'll take a one-minute break now and continue on this broadcast. This is Mae Brussel, and we'll take this 1 minute, and I'll be back with you in 60 seconds.